You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 30th of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Yet more of Brazil's cultural heritage goes up in flames. More governments attempt to ease the strains of the pandemic by giving away money. And the beginning of the end of the TV talent quest. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It is Friday, which means it's our week-ending in-house panel, and the names which emerged from the ceremonial tombola drum this week are those of Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Mara. They'll be discussing all the day's big stories, and we'll have the latest installment of our series considering the Olympics from a variety of national angles. Today, Switzerland. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Monocle 24's senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco and by Monocle's writer Louis Harnett O'Mara, two panellists who have enough names between them for a panel of three normal people. But it's just two of you. We should do some light introductory banter about the Olympics because there will be more Olympics coming up later in the show. And I just wanted to say today, I am delighted by two developments. One is, of course, the vanquishing of Team GB by the Matildas in the women's soccer, which was, you know, an absolutely epic win. And also, this is me kind of cheering on a Team GB athlete, which I do not do lightly as an Australian, but gold for Leytonstone in the women's BMX. That is, of course, God's own London suburb of Leytonstone, which is where Beth Shriver is from. And she won.
That's amazing. And BMX, you know, I never, to be honest, watched that much BMX, but it's quite interesting. A bit dangerous, though, but I quite enjoyed watching a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's quite crazy. I mean, also, we got, there was silver for GB with the men's BMX as well. So
that is true.
And that was from someone in Peckham.
It was from someone in Peckham.
Mm, so London seems to be picking up a few of the medals as we go.
And we've got to be honest about something. We were so negative about the Olympics, I think the whole world was. But let's be honest, there is something positive about it. Even the atmosphere here in the office, because everybody is cheering for their own countries. I don't know. It's been a happy week.
There was earlier, I should make clear to listeners, literally spontaneous office applause at a 10-hour-old replay of the women's trampolining just before we came on air.
That's beautiful, you know?
I heard a huge whoop go up from Daniel Bache earlier today, and everyone looked outside and he was strolling up and down. So I can only assume that was Olympics related also.
That's when they beat Brazil, actually. I was very sad, but you know.
Canada beat Brazil at something.
At football. Women's football, yeah.
Really?
Very sad.
But you got toweled up at football by the Canadians.
It's true. I mean, it's humiliating, but we did well. It was at the penalties, you know. Our girls did well as well.
You could still get on board the Matildas bandwagon. Fernando.
I will.
Similar colours, Australia
exactly,
and Brazil.
Exactly.
Very, very easy to confuse the two styles of play as well. More on the Olympics later in the show. The Games are approaching their halfway point, and after a year of agonising about whether they would or should go ahead amidst a pandemic, the first week has been, at the risk of tempting fate, relatively smooth sailing on the COVID-19 front, with just a handful of 11,000 or so competitors testing positive. With all the latest from on and off the field in Tokyo, here is Monocle 24's Olympics correspondent, Kieran Pender.
The Olympics are go. After all the umming and ahhing, the constant speculation over whether the Tokyo 2020 Games would ever actually happen, sport has finally taken centre stage. While the Olympics remain a source of political controversy in Tokyo, particularly with an alarming rise in domestic COVID cases, the excitement of the on-field action has helped distract from those wider concerns. Indeed, the Japanese are having a bumper Games. They currently sit second on the medal tally with 15 gold medals.
Now she's become one of the youngest individual Olympic champions in history. Japan's Momiji Niisha winning the inaugural women's skateboarding gold at the age of 13 years and 330 days. She finished.
Despite the fraught political context, such local success stories have been warmly received, no doubt as the International Olympic Committee had hoped. Elsewhere, we've had a thaw in American-Russian relations on the basketball court, and Simone Biles, one of the greatest gymnasts of all time, has taken a stand for athlete mental health by withdrawing from competition. I've come along to the Tokyo Aquatic Centre to watch one of the last days of the Olympic swim meet. Despite the pandemic-induced ban on fans, the Aquatic Centre has one of the better atmospheres of venues at Tokyo 2020 as swimmers and coaches cheer on their compatriots.
And from lane four, Trussell reaches in at 39.71.
My home nation of Australia has had a brilliant time in the pool. The Aussies currently sit equal with the Americans on 6 golds each. An Australian swim coach went viral this week for his exuberant celebrations. The Americans, on the other hand, are having a muted meet by their lofty standards, without their former talisman Michael Phelps and with freestyle superstar Katie Ledecky losing two of her favoured races. It's a heated rivalry between the two countries, and the Americans have some egg on their faces after much pre-Olympics hype.
Lily Hayden from News Corp Australia. Coming into the Games, you said that the US women would win every individual gold medal in the pool. What do you make of the Australians' performance in the past 2 days?
I feel like that quote has been twisted several times, and I've commented that on that since. I do feel like that was twisted, and the Aussies are swimming just fine. So there you go.
Next.
Just fine is certainly one way to describe 6 gold medals. But banter at the pool this week has also taken a darker turn. Russian swimmer Evgeny Rylov has won 2 gold medals, but critics, including American Ryan Murphy, who was on the podium with Rylov after both races, have suggested the field might not have been clean. While Murphy insisted that he was not making allegations against Rylov specifically, he added, quote, "I do believe there's doping in swimming, that is what it is." In Tokyo, the Russian team is competing under the banner of the Russian Olympic Committee rather than Russia itself, and without their own flag or national anthem.
We have a very familiar story, Russia doping and the seemingly interminable fight for clean sport. On Monday, the World Anti-Doping Agency banned Russia from all major sports events for the next 4 years, a period that would include the next Summer and Winter Olympics, and also the 20...
In response to the allegations at the Aquatic Centre, the Russian Olympic Committee issued a sarcastic statement.
English language propaganda. Oozing with verbal sweat in the Tokyo heat, through the mouths of athletes offended by defeats. We will not console you. Forgive us those who are weaker. God is their judge, and for us, an assistant.
While no country is completely free from doping concerns, at these games it is only Russia that must suffer the ignominy of receiving medals without the soundtrack of their national anthem. No such humiliation faced the Australians, who have heard their anthem belted more than once this week.
Ladies and gentlemen, the anthem of Australia. 皆様, オーストラリア国歌の演奏です。
For Monocle, in Tokyo, I'm Kieran Pender.
Thank you, Kieran, and if I sound somewhat distant from the microphone now, it is because I am, of course, still standing following that deployment of the Australian National Anthem. We should also note that the host nation, i.e. Japan, have been piling up the gold at such a Scrooge McDuck-like clip that they have added 2 more to their total since Kieran filed that dispatch. Fernando, I do just want to open up to the panel where we are on the Russians. That was actually, in fairness to them, some pretty solid banter there in that extremely baleful style that we have come to expect from the Russians. I think the Olympic Committee has taken the wrong approach by making them compete in neutral tracksuits and not have their anthem and stuff. I think we should have made them just dress up, like make them, you know, wear clown costumes or dress up as moose or something.
But you know what, Andrew, I actually don't think it's affecting them that much. Maybe you're right in that sense, because for some reason they're actually doing they had a better start than in the previous Olympics in Rio. So, you know, it's ROC, but I have a feeling, I think if you're Russian, you're still kind of celebrating in a way. So perhaps it wasn't such a harsh thing that the IOC did against them. But, you know, if the athletes are clean as well, it's a bit hard. It's a very difficult question. And I know not all athletes did the doping as well. So
Could we have played mocking music instead of the national anthem when they win something? Because they are being allowed to have things like, you know, excerpts from Tchaikovsky, which is still pretty cool.
It's quite cool, yeah. I prefer, as you say, clown music, you know, like as they come out, and maybe like on tiny bikes as they enter the stadium.
Make them all wear fezzes or something.
Mm, that would be much more appropriate.
So these are all ideas that the International Olympic Committee can have for free as they look towards Paris 2024. We will come back to the Olympics later in the show, but for now, it is nearly 3 years since Brazil's National Museum and many of the 20 million irreplaceable items it housed was consumed by fire. 3 years in which you'd have hoped serious attention would have been paid to the soundness of the facilities housing Brazil's cultural heritage. Yesterday, however, another fire severely damaged a film warehouse belonging to the Cinemateca Brasileira. It could have been worse. This was not their primary headquarters, but the losses are considerable. It has emerged, to nobody's great surprise, that workers at the warehouse had been warning for some while that it was a fire trap. Fernando, in terms of what we understand about what was lost in this fire, obviously it's not good, but how bad is it?
Well, we don't know the extent of the losses, but I have a feeling it'll be pretty bad, because the Cinemateca, you know, it's the most important. It's our national film archive, and perhaps I think it's the biggest one in South America as well. Hopefully, some things have been recovered, especially some originals. But I think that just says, the workers, they did complain. In fact, I think the last time they did it was back in April, so very recent. And it is quite shocking, the lack of investment in culture. And when I say lack of investment, it doesn't need to be a lot, but just kind of the minimum to keep up our museums alive. You mentioned the National Museum in Rio de Janeiro. We also had another museum in São Paulo of the Portuguese language, which is a beautiful museum that I've been and also caught fire a few years ago. I think it's about to reopen, but it is shocking because it's something that we know it's going to happen. And for this to happen in a museum where things should be protected, it doesn't make sense. And again, not surprising, because Bolsonaro, I think he is very open, actually, about it, that he doesn't invest in culture. It's not, I even think that his voters, probably he thinks it's not something that should be prioritized in a way. And not only culture, that includes sport as well. Most of our Olympic athletes, just to bring this up, to be honest, not all of them are supported by the government. There's, you know, you kind of have to make your own way to the Olympics in a way. There's not like a strong national program in a way.
But just on that, Fernando, is it your sense that Bolsonaro's this kind of belligerent philistinism that he often advances, do you think that's a shtick that he knows appeals to his voter base, or is that just him? Is that who he is?
I mean, I don't want to get any angry emails, but I genuinely think that's who he is in a way. I was even thinking, I wonder if he ever read a book. I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, he never showed any interest in culture. And when I say culture, it doesn't need to be highbrow, you know, it can be, any interesting musician or an interesting film that he's seeing, you know. Even when you see President Obama sending his summer reading list, I could never imagine Bolsonaro doing that. Perhaps you send like a military book that he didn't even read or something. So I think it's generally him.
But there is a worldwide curiosity here, it strikes me, Louis, that it's very often the case that the governments which and the politicians which position themselves as, you know, ardent nationalists, defenders of the flag and nation, are not merely indifferent to that nation's actual culture, but often entirely hostile to it.
Yeah, well, you get some strange viewpoints from these sort of Bolshevik figures. I mean, Donald Trump, for instance, he has some sort of interest in how things look. We know that because, like, he asked that all buildings that are made for government purposes be built in the neoclassical style. But it makes no sense. Neoclassical style isn't, you know, the vernacular of America. They've got beautiful modernist buildings, and that's a long-running history of American architecture. Not these sort of strange Corinthian columns that he wants to see being put back up. It doesn't necessarily make any sense. I mean, I suppose he's looking at culture, but from a very funny point of view.
I mean, Fernando, is there a way to make the case? Because this is a thing I've written about before for Monocle, that spending money on culture is actually, even if you only look at it in the most rigid profit and loss terms, it usually ends up working out pretty well. I remember writing a thing about this for Monocle once, and the illustration I used was in the early 70s, a Labour government in Australia spent what was at the time an astonishing amount of money to buy blue poles by Jackson Pollock, the American abstract painter for the National Gallery in Canberra. And at the time, this caused absolute uproar. You know, Australia was still a very insular and, you know, incurious and slightly isolated country. And at the time, this was regarded as an astonishing, profligate waste of public money. And I think even if you don't like the painting, the money they spent to buy it in the 1970s, I'm sure, has been made back a hundredfold on postcard sales alone.
Absolutely. And it helps the country in a way, even the country where we are at the moment. Look at the UK. Of course, there's been a very difficult political time, Brexit. You know, there are a lot of problems with it. But the UK is incredible, the way their soft power, the way they export their culture overall. I mean, and look at the UK. It's been difficult years for the UK, but the culture is still here. And I think, at least when people think of the UK, they don't only think of Brexit. They, you know, they have their favorite bands. They still have very important and strong museums, a strong acting scene, I mean, a strong film industry as well. And Brazil has that in a way, but with no support from the government. And that's the sad thing. We do have amazing artists, but there's absolutely no support, at least in this government. And I hope this will change.
Well, let's move on to another sort of government spending, and in particular, the practical application of what should, in theory, be about as popular a government policy as might be imagined. This would be the giving of free money to the citizenry. Various permutations of this have been floated around the world this last year and a half or so as a means of raising morale, alleviating despair, and mitigating against the economic damage caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. A couple of recent-ish examples. France has launched a smartphone app which gives every 18-year-old €300 to spend on cultural experiences, and Hong Kong is about to bung every resident vouchers coming to HK$5,000, about €540, which they have to spend, not save. Louis, I want to ask first of all you, because I think you're the one at this table who has the best memories of themselves as an 18-year-old, or at least the most recent memories of themselves as an 18-year-old. What would you have spent €300 on in terms of culture when you were 18 this time last week?
I wouldn't judge everyone by my own standards, but if I were 18...
You're trying to avoid telling us what you were into at 18, I can
sense.
Yeah,
I'm not entirely sure I'll divulge that just yet, but I mean, What would I have spent €300 on if I was 18? Probably going to the cinema, buying a few books and things like that. And I suppose that's kind of what they're doing. But I suppose what's interesting here is that France wants their 18-year-olds to go out and spend that money. And it's kind of trying to nudge them toward enjoying high culture. That's part of what this is about. And France being a, you know, kind of monolith for high culture, wants its 18-year-olds to begin participating in that. The problem is that they've been given this money and they've run out and they've spent it on manga. Which so about 50% of purchases with this money have been manga comics.
I'm with the young people now, you know. I think the French government, first of all, I think it's quite nice, actually, they're giving to young people because, you know, sometimes they don't have enough money to enjoy culture. And they should spend with whatever they want. I mean, culture is culture, I think. You know, maybe you can kind of nudge a little bit, but if they want to buy mangas, you know, let them do it.
So I was just thinking back to when I was 18. €300, I think, would have paid for, let's say, what, 20 albums of music? So €300, I could have bought a total of about, I don't know, 220 tracks of music.
Yeah.
which now seems like an entirely insane purchase.
It's a crazy amount of money for an 18-year-old. I can imagine what I'd do with it, 300 euros if I was 18. It's a lot of cash, and I think 19-year-olds are meant to be crying all over France. So.
I do like the idea, this somewhat perhaps naive idea that France had, as you were saying, Louis, that it would entice them away from their hula hoops and discotheques and towards the opera house and the art gallery. Mm. Not working out like that. Let's look at this initiative that Hong Kong is floating. This is an extremely low-rent version of Brewster's Millions, in that you get given 5,000 Hong Kong dollars, which does shake out at about 540 euros, but you have to spend it. So I'm not sure what the time limit actually is, but let's just say, Fernando, supposing I gave you 540 euros, which, just to be clear, is not a thing I'm going to do, and you had to spend it within the week, what would you spend it on?
Well, I did think quite hard about this. I mean, I wonder if, because, you know, actually what I really need, a very good facial to make me look less tired. Can you use that in the beauty industry?
Because I have literally no idea at this point what you're even talking about.
That's what I need. A good facial to make me less tired. And if they don't accept, I can buy clothes, you know.
I'm sort of on board with this. I mean, like, when I saw this, I was thinking, what would I buy? And something that I would never normally spend money on, but if I was given free money that I had to spend, a spa day. Would be so nice. I've never had a full spa day.
We're quite similar, Louis, in that way, actually.
Yeah, it would be lovely.
I am thinking of spending my 540 euros launching some sort of petition to reintroduce national service after what I've just heard from you two. Honestly, I despair. I really, really do. I'm going to despair further while we take a very short break. Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Meara, we will have more from you shortly after I've sent you out into the car park to do 50 push-ups each. You are listening to The Daily. More after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Another core principle at Allianz is a belief in equality of opportunity, and that diversity makes a company more innovative, more resilient, and better equipped for the future. Matt Stutzman is a Paralympic athlete, a decorated and world record-holding archer, and a man with a remarkable personal story of courage, resilience, and the single-minded pursuit of excellence. Matt Stutzman is here to tell us more about his story. Matt, talk to us a little about being confident and courageous in life, in your sport, whatever lies ahead.
For me, I have to have the confidence of knowing that I can make the shot when it matters. It's not being cocky. It's like very, very confident. I have to be able to step up to that line and being like, you know what? I'm going to put this in the middle. Watch this. And you have to train for that mentally every single day. I put myself in positions every single day that force me to think like that. And it can be as simple as, let's say I'm practicing with a beginner archer, and I'm helping them out, and we're at the range shooting together, and they're at 10 yards and I'm at 50 meters, but they shoot a shot that hits, you know, like a 9, right? I will immediately, even though they don't know this, I will make my next shot be against what they just shot, even though they're closer. I will push myself. So even if they shoot a 10, I'm gonna be like, okay, I'm gonna pretend that was my opponent who just shot that. And now it's my goal to make a shot that's better, closer to middle than what they just shot.
Athlete and inspiration Matt Stutzman on how he takes courage for what's ahead, no matter what. A clear passion, one that matches Allianz's own passion to secure people's lives. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Louis Harnett O'Mara and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, it is kind of amazing that the modern iteration of the TV talent show has lasted as far into the social media age as it has, given that it has been possible for some while now to enjoy, if that is your thing, the tone-deaf, warbling and frantic cavorting of talentless attention seekers as easily as calling up YouTube or, more recently, TikTok. However, X Factor, which first aired in 2004, has only just now been formally gonged off. While other similar bear pits remain available, this does seem a significant moment. Here, first of all, is Monocle's chief sub-editor, Lewis Huxley.
There are no plans for The X Factor to return to television screens in the UK, its host network ITV has confirmed. Good riddance. Simon Cowell's mawkish talent show subjected the British public to its bottom-of-the-barrel karaoke for 16 years, foisting upon us such musical catastrophes as Alexandra Burke's ham-fisted exclamation of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, forcing us to endure countless sentimental montages to the tune of Josh Groban's You Raise Me Up, and reducing the meaning of the word judge to a C-list celebrity with meagre musical knowledge, or none at all, who tells us whether an inane performance of some bland hit or other gave them the feels. Of course, you could dismiss The X Factor as harmless fun, but its premise always felt more sinister. Where Stars in Their Eyes, one of its Saturday night TV predecessors, had given Graham from Swansea the opportunity to dress up as Freddie Mercury for a night and belt out Don't Stop Me Now for a chance of winning the modest prize of performing again at the end of the show, The X Factor promised fame and riches to its contestants on the dubious premise that there was a musical genius just waiting to be discovered among the bricklayers and seamstresses of the land. With the odd exception, no sooner had the series ended than these wannabe wailers were cast aside without much in the way of support, no ownership of the music they recorded, and little choice but to reacquaint themselves with the cement mixer or sewing needle while the tabloid press documented their failure. The programme's organisers, meanwhile, took the money and the plaudits and moved on to the next round of star searching. And where has it left the British musical landscape? Well, for a nation that gave the world such luminaries as Edward Elgar, Ralph Vaughan Williams, The Beatles, Pink Floyd, Eric Clapton, Shirley Bassey, David Bowie, Brian Eno, Kate Bush, Massive Attack, Aphex Twin, Radiohead, I could go on. It's dispiriting that its recent musical history is filled with nondescript one-hit wonders by the likes of Ben Haynau. Remember him? Me neither. Thankfully, the influence of The X Factor and its ilk has waned over the past few years, and viewership has stagnated, hence the decision to pull it. The programme will continue in various guises in other countries, but will it be missed in the UK? It's a no from me.
Monocle's Lewis Huxley there. Fernando, how grief-stricken are you by the demise of The X Factor?
Well, I've got to be honest, not at all. I actually agree with Lewis at times, you know, because to be honest, I did watch The X Factor in the first years of X Factor. I thought it was a fun show, kind of different and exciting, but then it became too boring. I mean, they lost the contact, especially with young people. I generally think the people that were watching X Factor, they were much older. And even the acts, they were so boring, you know, ballads and very generic. Of course, they wouldn't be pop stars in the end because you need to have something different. And I think young people these days, it's not that I'm the biggest fan, but look at Billie Eilish. She had just released a new album this weekend. She didn't came with one of those shows, you know, but she's quite different, a little bit edgy, and I think that's what young people want these days. In my return, perhaps we should wait a few years, but I'm not going to miss it. Boring show.
See, I think it's... I agree with what Lewis Huxley had to say in that I don't recall any of these shows or any variation of them ever furnishing the world with one act that we could not possibly have lived without. But I will say that I did think, at least early on, Louis, I put it to you, that Simon Cowell, the heartbeat of X Factor, was actually performing some kind of a public service in that he was one of the few voices in public life willing to say to people, you're no good, you suck at this, you're terrible, which actually was kind of countercultural given the sort of general all must-have prizes, good vibes of the modern era.
Yes. So
I mean, clearly he's doing a shtick and he's entirely insincere and he couldn't care less, but nonetheless, I thought there was some value to that.
There's something fun about seeing people shot down. And, you know, there are clips that I see on YouTube, as you say, where you see people singing and they're hilariously bad, and then Simon Cowell tears them to shreds. However, it's worth remembering that these are people who are vetted, told that they're brilliant, with the producers knowing full well that they're going to absolutely flop on stage and everyone will laugh at them. Sometimes they've even got, you know, mental disabilities, and they'll put them in front of crowds and everyone will point and laugh, lo and behold. And Simon Cowell will say something horrible, will say, "I've never heard such a banshee in my life," and then we'll send them off on their way. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's not exactly difficult for what he does, but he has made me laugh. I will admit that. However, counterculture in a way, also, it's almost too easy.
What was the cruelty, the point, Fernando?
Well, to be honest, I think a lot of people did watch the show for the cruelty in a way. And I have to say, even though I told you that in the show there's been a lot of boring contestants in recent years, there's been some kind of gems here and there. I mean, look at One Direction. I mean,
must we?
Yeah, we do. We must look at that. Because look at Harry Styles. I mean, he's one of the biggest pop stars at the moment. And he's not quite X Factor, but I believe the Spice Girls were created in one of those shows as well.
Spice Girls were not, but Girls Aloud were.
Excellent music as well. Some great electropop beats, you know. So there's been some little gems here and there, but the format is tired. I think they did the right decision because the ratings were pretty bad as well. But, you always have Eurovision. I mean, the music competitions will not be over. Of course, I had to mention that, right?
I think Eurovision would be immeasurably improved by equipping a short-tempered judge, and I'd be happy to volunteer for the job with a gong and just having them at the side of the stage. I will now, having thought that through a bit further, concede that if that was me by the side of the Eurovision stage with a gong, the whole thing would be over in about 5 minutes.
Exactly.
You do have to be a particular type of man, though, to be a judge on those. I mean, Simon Cowell reportedly had black toilet paper in every bathroom in his house. I don't know what that says.
I don't even know where you would go about getting that.
I prefer the white one.
Yeah, I think
okay,
so.
Okay, I fear we may be deviating from the point somewhat. And on that note, we should end today's show with our ongoing series on the Olympics. For the duration of the Games, we have been asking some of Monocle's hilariously international staff to reflect on their particular favourite Olympic moment. Today's instalment comes from our Zurich Bureau and Monocle's and Switzerland's Desiree Bandley. Here she looks at Nicolas Spirig's winning gold in the triathlon in 2012 with a lead of only 0.9 seconds, the closest Olympic triathlon finish ever.
It is not uncommon for Olympic races to be decided by inches. But what Nicola Spirig managed to do in London 2012 is rather spectacular. She won the triathlon by 0.9 seconds, the closest race ever in the young Olympic history of the triathlon. It's a young sport. The first triathlon was only in the 2000 Games in Sydney and consists of a 1.5-kilometer swim, a 40-kilometer bike ride, and a 10-kilometer run. And the Swiss love to compete in it. Following the UK, we are the second best nation at it in the Olympics and the first country to win two gold medals in the women's competition. One of them is the remarkable one I am about to tell you about.
Look out for the two Swiss girls there, Daniela Ruf and Nicola Spirig. Spirig in magnificent form this season, winner in Madrid recently on the World Series.
On that sunny day in 2012 in London, Spirig was one of the favourites, having just won a third European championship in the last 4 years. Spirig's tactic has been the same for many years, staying close to the leaders in the first two disciplines to outrun the competition in the last segment. And that's precisely what she did. It even looked like she was going to win relatively easy, but the Swedish Lisa Norden approached Spirig with great strides, and they did end up crossing the finish line with the exact same time.
Look at this, nothing between them as they go into the tape. Might have been Norden, or was it Spirig? Well, they've given it to Spirig.
I think that's a dead heat.
Wow, yeah. I mean,
after that, the confusion started. This has never happened in triathlon. No one really knew what that meant. The Olympic commentator mentioned a dead heat would be the only fair option. The Swiss commentator was sure Spirig won. Lisa Norden was celebrating on the floor. It was all a bit of a mess around the finish line. The confusion was only lifted after a closer look at the photo finish. Spirik's foot did cross the line 0.9 seconds before Norden's, and she was declared the winner.
It's Nicholas Spirik who's been given first place in 1:59.48, exactly the same time as Ellen Norden, the Norwegian, who crossed the line with her. But at the moment, it looks as if it might be Spirik that's going to get the gold medal.
That year, Spirik won an Olympic gold medal, their European championship, and was voted best female athlete in Switzerland. What a year for the charming Swiss.
It was a big, big goal for me. I worked really, really hard to achieve that. I had so much support from my boyfriend Rito, from my family and from my coach Brett Sutton. It means a lot. It's not the world. I have other things in life, but it's for my sports, it's the highest I can imagine.
Such a dramatic win. It was also the first Olympic medal for Spirik and the first Swiss trophy in London, still resonates with the Swiss to this day. The otherwise rather reserved alpine dweller regularly approaches her to tell her how her win made them feel. It is unbelievably satisfying to see hard work being paid off, especially when such a down-to-earth athlete is at the receiving end of it. Spirik stands for values that we, the Swiss, just love. She works hard, is very humble, but also ambitious at the same time. Unsurprisingly, her next project is also one to look out for. The 39-year-old, who has just come sixth in Tokyo at her fifth Olympics, takes part in a Netflix series documenting her preparation to finish an Ironman in under 8 hours. A benchmark which has never been undercut so far. Merci Nicola for all the memories and hopefully many more to come. For Monocle 24, I'm Desiree Bundy.
Thank you, Desiree, and your private orchestra, by the sound of it. They're really living it up over in the Zurich Bureau. Quick fun chat on Olympics to end the show, it says here. So let's do exactly that. What are we now looking forward to?
Well, I was looking at the 100 metres. I mean, so...
It's a controversial choice.
Well, I mean, it is coming up. And who's going to be the next fastest man? I mean, Usain Bolt, his tenure has ended. He's had his decade run. And it has gone well. But, I mean, I was looking at the contenders here, and we've got quite a few from the US and one from Canada, one from South Africa. But basically, it's an open field. People aren't really sure who's going to pick up this trophy now, which it hasn't been for a very long time, as we know. So I'm going to be watching out for that. I think that'll be a really, really fun one to watch.
See, I'm going to be controversial. I'm kind of not looking forward to the 100 metres without Usain Bolt, because one of my favourite things about watching any sport is when you get to see that person to whom it just looks so incredibly preposterously easy, and that even when they're put up against the absolute very best the world has to offer, still just kind of looks like they're phoning it in and it's not really that hard. I mean, I can't recall which one of his 100 metres it was, but which is the one that he basically skipped the last 20 metres twirling a parasol and waving to the crowd? I'm going to miss Usain Bolt. I really am.
He had his shoelaces undone.
There
as
was
well,
one
as
where he had his shoelaces undone, which I would really like to think was deliberate, that he just sort of waited there at the start line thinking, let's see if I can make this interesting. Mm. I know. Fernando, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I look forward for the four finals for volleyball, men's and women's volleyball and men's and women's beach volleyball.
Is this a Brazil thing?
Absolutely. And I think we might have a chance to be in the final for all the four of them. Brazil tends to do very well with volleyball, so of course I'll keep my eyes on that.
And I will be mostly watching this weekend the BMX freestyle, which isn't quite as mayhemic as the BMX racing, in which, just to remind our listeners, Leighton Stone won a gold medal earlier today. But it is still honestly spectacular because, again, it's one of those sports where you just get a real glimpse into the absolutely abysmal gulf that exists between you, for example, and the kind of people who can actually do that kind of thing.
Mm, yeah, I would like to be good on the BMX, but sadly...
There's still time.
I could hop on one, but I'm a bit scared.
That's what you could spend your 5,000 Hong Kong dollars on. See, that is a slightly more badass choice than a spa day.
Yeah,
Louis.
We even thought about doing the Olympics here in Midori House, but just with staff members. I mean, people were shouting and jumping all over. I mean, that's perhaps I'm revealing too much here.
We'll put you in charge, Fernando. You can decide on the event.
I will.
And let's see how that goes. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panelists today, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Louis Harnett O'Mara, and to Monocle's Olympic correspondent Kieran Pent in Tokyo and Desiree Bandley in Zurich and Lewis Huxley here in London. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineers were Chris Ablakwa and David Stevens. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Goodbye and thanks for listening.